Welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. We have a couple of really interesting guests for you tonight. Suzanne Lang, who produces the show, and I were just talking about them. Suzanne, I think that Deborah Rodriguez is one of the most amazing women I've ever met. She lived in Afghanistan and operated a beauty school there. And for a while, she had a coffee shop. And now she's written this wonderful novel, which is certainly gives one an entirely different view of Afghanistan. There's plenty of shooting in it. Don't worry about that. But she's talking to people about their everyday lives there. She has amazing energy. And what a story.
You guys had a great conversation about her books.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed her. And then you talked with Brooke Holvey.
Brooke Holvey is a Sonoma County artist who works with books. She has a couple of shows going on, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk to her about how she incorporates books into her work. So in the second half of the show, we'll hear that conversation I had with her.
Well, let's go with it. Here is Deborah Rodriguez reading from her brand new book, A Cup of Friendship.
The coffee house was jammed with regulars, misfits, missionaries and mercenaries, Afghans and foreigners, and Sunny, as usual, was at the counter. She surveyed her domain, pleased with the business, the buzz, the life that pulsated in the room. This was her very own place, here in the middle of a war zone, in one of the most dangerous locations on the earth. After a lifetime of hard luck and bad choices, finally, at the age of 38, she found a home. Sunny was the center of the cafe, and she planned never to leave. Kabul was a perfect place for her. Since nothing here was on solid ground, anything was possible and anything could happen. 5 men had just walked in, dressed in black, foster grands hiding their eyes, machine guns slung over their shoulders, sidearms hanging from their waist. She hadn't seen such beautiful men in a long, long time. In another country, they'd mean trouble. But here, she knew they were 5 tall lattes and a plate of biscottis.
You've been listening to Deborah Rodriguez read a passage from her latest book, A Cup of Friendship. Deborah, it's such a pleasure and an honor to have you here in the studio.
Oh, I love it. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, yes. And what an amazing book. A Cup of Friendship is just brand new, published 2011 by Random House, available in your local bookstore and online. And Deborah, you're currently traveling with the book.
Right. Today is actually my last day of tour. So, yeah, I've been traveling for the last couple of weeks.
You'll be happy to go home.
I will be, actually, but I've really enjoyed myself.
Oh, good. And home is?
Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm going to warm weather.
Lovely.
No snow.
Mm-hmm. Right. A Cup of Friendship is your second book about Afghanistan. I think that I learned more about Afghanistan from your book, how it would be to live there, than any book I've read about Afghanistan.
That was the intention, was to entertain and educate, because I think that it's really difficult. You know, you're seeing Afghanistan on the news. So that means you're seeing suicide bombings, you're seeing, you know, all the icky stuff, and just really, you know, the scrolling across the CNN channel, but that's it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really have any idea. You forget that there's so many foreigners over there. You forget about how the East is clashing with West. You don't know these things. The concept with this book was to bring in some really current, very viable people that would actually be in Afghanistan, set them in a place that we can all relate to. I had a coffee house in Afghanistan, so I know that these sorts of people are in the coffee house. And that was really crucial, and that everything that happened in the book could have happened in real-life Afghanistan.
Yes. What I liked about it is you made it clear that no matter what is going on in the country, war, peace, whatever it is, life goes on. Someone is getting dinner. Someone's falling in love. Someone's doing well in school. Life goes on. And that's what you've written about in A Cup of Friendship.
Well, and it does. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a hairdresser also.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I said, no matter what's going on in the world, war, no war, your hair still grows.
Right. Another aspect of life in Afghanistan that we may not be as aware of as we should is the amazing variety of people of different religions, different tribes, different languages, different customs within Afghanistan.
And now that you have so many foreigners in there, you have, you know, a little added to the mafias and all this sort of stuff, too. But there's everything there. And they're clashing, too. You know, I mean, you have things that are not clashing, but you do have some situations between the fact that the Westerners are there and, you know, the traditional people are there. It's an amazing place to be.
And since you lived for several years in Afghanistan, in Kabul yourself, you have the firsthand knowledge of how the city is and how the various conflicts can arise between people and between groups within the city.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And one of the clues to me was that there weren't any street directions.
Oh, I know.
There was Paint Street and Chicken Street, but you kind of had to say the house with the blue door down the street from the whatever.
Turn left at the sheep that are grazing on the medical waste outside the hospital. I became a vegetarian at that point. And then go to the blue gate and turn right until you see the Nokia sign. I mean, it was right. Insane. And if the sheep were grazing someplace else, you were lost.
You were lost,
yeah.
Right. So you have this wonderful setting now for your story, the city of Kabul in Afghanistan. And then to me, it was as though you were all ready for a play and you were going to bring the characters on. And you bring them on kind of one at a time, and we get to know them and feel comfortable with them. And it was like putting a tapestry together.
It's a coffee house. Yes. I mean, just put yourself in a coffee house. Now you're the only person you know in the coffee house.
Mm-hmm.
You're by yourself. And each day, you know, you're there every day, and somebody comes and starts weaving themselves into your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly because it becomes like Cheers, where everybody knows your name. You know, it's one of those places where it is a coffee house, and all of a sudden, there's these amazing people that you're just there to, you know, do internet and drink a cup of coffee. And now some of the most amazing people have just walked in your life. All of a sudden, in this setting, with war as the backdrop, you bond. Everybody is on even ground, and it's unstable ground at that. No matter what they do for a living, no matter how much money they make, no matter what. And so the friendships bond really, really fast and really tight. And that's very, very real.
Can you pick out your enemies when they appear, or is that a little trickier?
That's trickier, actually.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It is, because we used to say it would be funny. We'd be going through the airport from in Dubai, and we'd see somebody coming from Afghanistan. You know, you'd be going into the country, and you could see they were coming out. And, you know, there was a foreigner with a carpet draped over his shoulder with this glazed look, it's like, he just got out of the vortex. I mean, it is. It's where it's almost like your entrance would be the smoke coming out, and then all of a sudden they enter. I mean, it is a cloudy vortex. Mm-hmm. You cannot often tell who's who, what's what. And it's so many men. I called it in the Kabul Beauty School book, I used to call it Manistan versus Afghanistan. It was so many men. There were not enough women. You didn't see the Afghan women very much, and there weren't that many foreign women. And because of security, you wanted girlfriends. And so you're kind of searching them out. You just want to trash talk. You want to do all this stuff, and there are no women. And so the coffee house was this real safe venue for women. And so I missed my girlfriend so much. And so that was why I wanted a coffee house in real life
And the first character you bring onto the stage is a woman, an Afghan woman, Yasmina.
An amazing woman.
And her sister, Layla.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about...
Well, Yasmina is from Nuristan. One of the places that I had always wanted to go to was Nuristan. It's on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it used to be called Kafiristan. And Kafir meaning unbeliever, Stan meaning the land of, because they did not convert to Islam when the rest of the country did. So about 100 years or so back, they converted to Islam or were forced to convert, and now it's called Nuristan, which is a land of light. These are the direct descendants of Alexander the Great. So they are the green-eyed people. They have the lighter skin, the lighter hair, the green eyes. The National Geographic, the girl on the cover, it's what the Nuristani people would look like.
I thought of her immediately.
Yeah. Her family, they're goat herders up there. And her, you know, as many, many people, their family, their mother and father were killed during the war by the Taliban. And she then became like a ward to her uncle. Her husband died and by a landmine. So again, she's now living with the uncle because the families live together. And she is pregnant. Well, Afghanistan, in real Afghanistan, had some serious harsh winters. And so I wanted to bring that into the book. And Yasmina's uncle is a goat herder, and the winters were really, really harsh, and it killed all the goats. Now he has to borrow money to buy more goats, and he's got a money lender, and he isn't able to pay it back. And they take Yasmina as payment. This is not that uncommon. Women are used as currency. Not that the uncle wanted to sell her or give her away, but it was out of force. Mm-hmm. And
she was kidnapped.
Basically, mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Stolen, kidnapped. Stolen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that sets the tone for the book. And then the next person we meet in the book is Sunny.
Right.
Sunny, who is operating this coffee shop in the middle of Kabul.
Right.
She's a wonderful... I know you called her Sunny. That's a perfect name for her.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's realistic, but she's just a happy person.
Yeah.
And walking a tightrope there with all these various factions to contend with. And from the portion that you read, these beautiful guys with machine guns and giving them biscotti. I mean, that says it all. Did you know someone like Sunny?
Well, you know, Sunny is a combination of, myself, mm-hmm. And some very unusual and strong, amazing women that I had met in Afghanistan. They are my girlfriends, mm-hmm. They're my girlfriends, and I combined them all together to make like Super Sunny.
Yeah. Then there's the staff. There's the cook, Bashir.
Bashir Hadi.
He was great, and nothing bothered him.
Bashir Hadi, he is Hazara, and I really felt that it was very, very important to bring in an ethnic person, because the Hazaras were exceptionally persecuted in Afghanistan. They were treated like donkeys. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the Sunni and Shia. The Hazaras are the Shia, and they are outcasts. I mean, the things that were done to the Hazaras, and where the big Bamyan Buddhas were, the Hazara.
Oh.
That was where the Hazaras were. So some of the – so they have that Mongolian look.
Yes.
They have a stronger Asian look. So you can definitely see the Hazara Afghans different than the, say, Pashtun Tajik Afghans. Uzbeks have a tendency to have a same sort of look. But I felt it was really crucial to hear – his side.
His voice.
Because he's so nice.
Oh, he is. He's lovely.
He's so nice. He's and lovely. Then when he does finally to have his voice, listen.
Yes.
Because he doesn't say a whole lot that's negative whatsoever. But
right.
He's had some issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his struggle has not been easy in Afghanistan. Being an Afghan for him is not always easy.
Yes. And then there's Hallajohn.
Oh, right. Hallajohn is the back before all the war happened. Hallajohn was like this cool chick wearing the miniskirt, you know, hanging out, smoking cigarettes, hanging out with the college kids, you know, that sort of thing. She was in progressive Kabul. She was in the, you know, like the Manhattan. And now she is in a burqa. And so she's, you know, she's older, but her heart is young.
That's right.
And it, I always say that it's better to have never had than to have had a had and lost. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what Hallajohn lost her freedom. And so this is really hard for her. Some of these kids now in Afghanistan, they've only seen war. Mm-hmm. Hallajohn saw freedom. Hallajohn lived a normal life in Afghanistan, and now it's all gone. So she's always reflective of that, and she's sassy. Yeah, I mean, she's got the wisdom, and she's spunky, and she'll tell you, you know, just the way it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful foil to Sunny. The two of them together there in the cafe work so well together. And then there's a couple of guys. There's Tommy, who Sunny has a thing for. And then there's Jack, who's a little more complex character and a strange guy.
Well, Jack, I have to say, there was this guy that used to come into the coffee house. I mean, he was this very aloof, funny, and warm, knew all the languages. I never knew what he did. It's like, what do you do? And he's like, oh, I'm a consultant. Well, right, whatever. And I didn't know him that well, and I saw him come in. He would come in, all of a sudden, he'd be there every day at 8 o'clock and had the same food. Then he'd be gone for 3 months. Then he'd come in every day, and it was so weird. And then I never saw him again. I never got his email address or anything, so I didn't get in contact with him. But I thought, wow, who is this guy?
And since you're a writer, you create
a
life form.
Yeah, yeah. I made him into kind of like the guy that every woman really would like to have in her life.
Yes.
He's strong. He's sensitive.
Yes. George Clooney will play him in the movie,
I'm thinking George. Yeah. Really, that would be good, right?
Then who walks in but Candace Appleton and Joaquil.
Right.
What a pair.
Yeah.
She's a platinum blonde. She's the blonde, isn't she?
Yeah. She's the woman that is always put together, wearing the high shoes. And her feet don't hurt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's got the perfect – she's – perfect. And she's that woman none of us like.
Right.
Yeah, she's her. We
dislike her immediately.
Immediately.
And so does Sunny.
Yeah.
Sunny can't stand her.
Yeah. And Joaquil is this gorgeous Afghan who's aloof and just like I am so above you and, you know, just kind of you feel snobbed.
Yes.
And you don't like – you don't trust him and you don't like her.
And you, the author, gave us all kind of clues that he was up to no good.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of those in Afghanistan,
I'm
too.
Sure.
Slick.
So we knew Candace would get her comeuppance in some way because she was with this sleazy guy.
Yeah. But you don't think he's sleazy. He's slick.
He's slick. Right.
Slick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he has this little school for orphan boys.
Right.
And you think, I wonder what that's all about.
Right.
Right. Right. A couple more people. Peter, the gorgeous Uzbek, tall, gorgeous Uzbek, who's also as mysterious as Jack.
Right. You would have these guys come in and you have no idea why they're there. And they're gorgeous. They were tall. They had this accent and, you know, they had expensive shoes on, expensive coats. They had their, you know, man bag and all this sort of stuff. And you're thinking, who are you and what mafia just brought you in? I mean, they're oozing money and they never give you quite a straight answer to why they're there. You really want to think that they're probably in the drug related field because there's just, why are they there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what humanitarian act are they doing?
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. They're strictly there. There's something illegal there. Yeah. And you see that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, that can't be good.
Yeah. And he's with Isabel.
Right.
And you think, what's Isabel doing with a guy like that? Isabel was an interesting character, too, a journalist.
Right.
A very, very daring journalist.
Isabel is haunted by her past. I think that as beautiful as she is, I think she struggles with low self-esteem. And so I think she's just had a lot, some failure in her life. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't quite believe in herself as much as she should. And so she latches on, you know, the type of gals who latch on to the bad boys.
Yes.
You know, she's latching on to the bad guy because, you know, she's trying to fill that void somehow. Mm-hmm. She's filling voids in her life. And by keeping moving, by not being in one place very long, you don't have to feel anything. And Isabel's trying not to feel anything because mm-hmm. what she feels when she stops and she's alone with herself, mm-hmm. she doesn't like what she feels. Mm-hmm. So she keeps moving mm-hmm. and she keeps, you know, throwing alcohol on top of it and throwing mm-hmm. strange men on top of it. And therefore, she doesn't have to feel.
Yeah. It's sad.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people like that.
That's true. But you feel sad for Isabel.
You do. You do. You want to say, wake up, girlfriend.
You're better than this.
Yeah, you don't need that. You don't need this. Just mm-hmm. stop a minute. Mm-hmm. And Sunny feels that. She wants to, you know, just kind of shake her out of this. It's like, geez, you know, she doesn't feel worthy, you know, and that's what it really screams.
Right. So now you have most of your cast of characters assembled, and your stage is set for the action to begin. And
well, then you got Ahmed.
Ahmed. I forgot Ahmed.
Yeah, Ahmed. Whoa. You know, Ahmed was a real small player when the book first started.
That's right.
He was not a very – in fact, Ahmed, I overlooked basically, and I remember, you know, he was a part. He was just the gatekeeper. He was opening and shutting the doors. Right. To me, he was not a big player in the scene at all. And Random House actually said, "We like him.
Yes.
Make him bigger."
Yes.
But he became quite an interesting character. He developed kind of like Candace developed.
He developed,
and I mean, and you really see the conflict between a young man and the culture, the religion, East and West. You see a lot of these, you know, their heart. You see his heart. You see the conflict.
Yeah.
And what he has been thought was right, what he feels is Islam, and just the confusion and getting the conflict or maybe not understanding culture in Islam. Because there's a big difference there, what one would think is the religious view and what is the cultural view. And he grows the most.
He does.
He could have gone either way.
Yes, that's right. And almost went the wrong way.
Yeah.
Hala John is his mother.
Right.
Which was a beautiful way to show the relationship, his responsibility that he felt for his mother.
Right.
He didn't begin to understand her because she had grown up in another time. But the father was gone, and it was up to him to care for his mother in every sense of the word.
Exactly.
I enjoyed so much watching his growth, and I was pulling for him all the way in what his heart was telling him to do.
Right.
Yeah.
I like Ahmed.
Yeah.
Right.
when I read a book, you know, I read for the story. I love a good story. But if I don't become attached to the characters, I don't keep going.
Right.
And so you had me from the very beginning. But, you know, just the as soon as I got through the first few pages of this book, I was committed to the people that I was meeting on the page. And that is one of the greatest gifts that a writer can give her readers. I'm telling you, people out there, get hold of this book, A Cup of Friendship by Deborah Rodriguez. It's not only a good read, you'll learn something, and it's full of wonderful characters. Yeah. We're going to take a break now, and this is Rosemary Manchester. You're listening to A Novel Idea. I'm talking with Deborah Rodriguez about her book, A Cup of Friendship, and when we come back, we're going to talk about her first book, Kabul Beauty School.
Kapıl can deri deri spini vavrayı poğruna. Dağran Afganistan orna tavdi turtur kruna. Dağran Afganistan orna tavdi turtur kruna. Kapıl can deri deri spini vavrayı poğruna. Dağran Afganistan orna tavdi turtur kruna. Dağran Afganistan orna tavdi turtur kruna.
Let's get back to A Novel Idea with Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Deborah Rodriguez.
Okay, we're back. This is Rosemary Manchester. You're listening to A Novel Idea, and Deborah Rodriguez is here in the studio with me. We've been talking about her novel, which just came out. It's a brand new book called A Cup of Friendship. Incidentally, it's a beautiful book. It will jump off the shelf at you. The cover is just gorgeous, and so is the book. In 2007, Deborah published Kabul Beauty School, which is a true story about her years in Afghanistan as a beautician and an instructor of budding beauticians. How is it that you happen to go to Afghanistan? Why Afghanistan?
I took disaster relief training. And,
yeah.
In August, I'm a hairdresser, right? And I was just a little bit bored. So I went to Chicago because I'm originally from Michigan. I went to Chicago and I took disaster relief training August 2011. Well, you know, September 11 happened and my team was deployed out and we did massage therapy for the firefighters at Ground Zero. And then after that, the same team, about 9 months later, went to Afghanistan to open up medical clinics because I was with OBGYNs and they were female and there wasn't, you know, the women had not been able to be checked for a long, long time. So I went with them. But the problem was I wasn't medical and I was kind of useless on the team. So you know, I'm doing the laundry. And they said to me, so did you bring your scissors? I says, I did. And so I started cutting not only their hair, but there was a lot of media there. You know, CNN, mm-hmm. ABC, Fox yes. News, everybody got a haircut. So I set up shop. Then I was trying to figure out why is it that these people have waited 3 months for a haircut? Don't they have, you know, hairdressers, barbershops here? Well, they did. And you know, I really didn't care so much about the barbershops because I'm a hairdresser. And we were more worried about the women at this time. And so I wanted to see why is it that nobody was using the beauty shops. And then I had a hard time finding them. Right. And they had gone underground and they didn't have any tools. And so that was, you know, the idea of trying to help these, you know, these are my hairdressing sisters.
Yes.
So I felt like I was the only, you know, yes. Western hairdresser in the country that had seen this. And I felt it was my job. I was given this visual, this I saw it and I couldn't turn my back on it. So that's why we started the school.
Yeah. And then some of the companies in the United States sent you stuff.
Pretty much almost all the Western beauty supplies and shampoos. Mm-hmm. Paul Mitchell was the first one to really, really come in and he just said, you know, what are you doing? What do you need? He was amazing. And once he came on board and I could say to all the rest of them, well, Paul Mitchell, you know, then everybody else came on board. So we, you know, we had enough shampoo to shampoo the entire country a couple times over.
Could probably use it.
And we did. I mean, you know, it was good because we could give them as gifts, as graduation gifts for the students. I mean, it was huge, huge, huge because getting shampoo there was just a nightmare.
Oh, the idea of what we take for granted here and what's actually so precious. Yeah. You tell the story of a young woman that you were very, very much taken with, Roshana. Did I say your name correctly?
Yes.
Roshana. Could you talk a little bit about her?
Oh, Roshana was, you know, she's this really amazing young woman who was forced to, well, she wanted to get married again. She had been promised or engaged.
Yes.
What I had a hard time is understanding what engagement meant there.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that was the problem. See, right. A lot of times the men would be from another country. They'd be Afghan, German, Afghan, whatever. They would come into the country and they would say they are engaged. But what they do is they actually make a legal wedding so that when they are trying to get them into their country, they're already married. But they're not, according to the family, they're not really married. So her husband, who she was engaged to and had the legal wedding, basically raped her. And went back to his country or the country he was living in. I think you forget that it isn't always just the women who are being pressured to do things. He didn't want to marry Roshana no more than the man on the moon. But the bottom line is his family was saying, you need to come to this country and take an Afghan bride. And he had a family.
Yes.
He was living his life quite happily, and now, you know, this has to happen. So this really, when she does need to get married, and she, you know, when she's getting married again, she's not a virgin.
She's not a virgin.
And this is a huge problem. I've known of girls who have, they kill them. I mean, it could be as much as death. And it, depending on the community, but it shames the family so much. There's been families who have had to leave the village because they're so shamed. Your act is not an individual act, no matter what you do. It's all about the family. It's not about you. It's about you, your brothers and sisters, your mother and father, your aunts and uncles, their aunts and uncles, their cousins. And I mean, we're talking like hundreds of people are affected by one thing you do. And that's a concept we as Americans do not understand because we're so independent.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that
it's a very complicated culture.
And so cruel.
Yeah, and it's cruel to – I mean, I knew a man who was married to an American, and he was – when he went to go visit his family, he was literally thrown in jail because they – until he signed the marriage papers for the second wife. So then he had to go back home and tell his wife in America that, yeah, well, while I was in Afghanistan, they made me get married. Had no choice. He was being beaten every day till he signed the papers to marry her. Mm-hmm. They were not going to let him out of jail.
Mm-hmm. We don't know enough about Afghanistan, do we?
And that's why I try to write these books. You know, I try to make it in a – I don't want to – I simplify it so
no,
that
– No, you don't – you, you
No,
just,
you bring it down to the level that – You can yes. kind of relate to
yes.
because what is there in Afghanistan mm-hmm. that you can relate to?
Yes.
You can't. It's just this faraway place. But when you take it and you make it into individual women
yes.
or, you know, you take the setting and you put it in a coffee house or you take the setting and you put it in a beauty school or a salon, mm-hmm. you can put yourself there and you can somewhat relate to it. That's what I try to do.
But when you write these books, you make it personal. You present these characters that we can identify with. And the amazing thing to me that is in making it personal, it becomes universal.
Yeah.
Because then we realize, oh, that's what happens.
Right.
And if I lived there, that could happen to me.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the most valuable tools that a writer can, well, a writer who's been a lot of amazing places and done unusual things as you have. It's the perfect way to bring in the rest of us who haven't had those experiences.
Well, you know, it's a wonderful way to get a very big message out to a lot of people.
Yes.
You know, it's not just about writing a book.
Yes, that's right.
There's a message here.
Right. And the fact that it's a good read doesn't matter.
Yeah, that always helps, right?
And after after you organized your beauty school and you were training the young Afghan women, you did that for several years.
5 years.
For 5 years. And
yeah.
That wasn't easy.
No. I mean, There's no electricity. I mean,
and also the antagonism of the society, where it was really wasn't. The women are so segregated from the yeah. the life of society, and of course they had their own life behind closed doors.
Exactly.
And in the beauty salon, those were wonderful scenes when they rushed in the door, threw off their burkas, and had at it.
And they are. They're very colorful women. I mean, women are women. Mm-hmm. Wherever. A beauty shop is a beauty shop. I mean, what do you, we sat and trash talked the husbands. Oh my goodness. We had more fun laughing. They are brutal. I mean, there was no husband got, away without being slashed. It was fun.
And then a custom that was unfamiliar to me, but it sounded beautiful, was the painting with henna of their hands and their feet.
Yeah.
What a lovely thought.
It's very Indian.
Ah.
That whole region, it has, it's the Mindi. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Deborah, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you about your books. I guess our listeners can figure out that I like your books very much. Your first book, The Kabul Beauty School, and then the second one, the novel, A Cup of Friendship. They're available at your local independent bookstores, and they're available online. I know that The Kabul Beauty School is in the public library, and if A Cup of Friendship isn't, it will be soon. It is a brand new book. And I encourage all of you to get the books for yourselves and read the beautiful stories that Deborah has put together for us. What are you doing now?
What we do now, the Kabul Beauty School closed. I left the country in 2007, but I did not want to end this whole philosophy of doing hair in Afghanistan. So what we do now, I have an organization called Oasis Rescue, and you can look at it online, oasisrescue.com. And also we have a Facebook. But what we do is called a beauty shop in a box. And we create these boxes, and we've brought them to Iraq, to the refugees there, to Jordan, the refugees there, and Afghanistan. And it's everything a woman needs to do hair, to learn hair. And we're continuing our training for the women in hairdressing via the beauty shop in a box. And we're thrilled. And it's really been going so well. It's a great, great tool for these women.
And we can read about that on
my website.
On your website.
Yep. You can see my website, DeborahRodriguez.com, and then OasisRescue.com.
OasisRescue.com.
Yes.
Yes. And if people want to be a part of your beauty in a box, they can contribute?
Yes, and you can find out everything you want to know, and you can contact me via on my website.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful idea. You talk about making the world more beautiful, and you're doing it on a personal level.
Yeah, and one haircut at a time.
One haircut at a time. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that time with Deborah Rodriguez. And now I'm looking forward to Brooke Holvey.
Brooke is a Sonoma County artist who has been on this show before talking about her work for The Big Read. She did some installations for both Fahrenheit 451 and To Kill a Mockingbird. She is part of a show right now at Quicksilver Gallery, and I thought it'd be fun to talk with her because she works in books.
Quicksilver Gallery, that's in Forestville, isn't it?
Right on Main Street in Forestville. And so they have an interesting show up right now about words in art, and they'll be having an opening reading on February 24th, if any of you are interested in going to that. Let's listen to that conversation that I had with Brooke Rosemary.
Okay, I'm looking forward to hearing your conversation with Brooke.
Brooke Holvey, happy to have you in the studio today to talk about your work, which I've enjoyed over the years, and I find to be ethereal yet grounded in objects. And I think I'd like you to explain the nature of your work, if you can.
I can speak to two shows, one that I'm in at the moment and one that is coming soon. But yes, there is that sense of materiality and sort of universal themes of timelessness, ethereal, immateriality, whatever one wants to call it. And I am currently very interested in materials that speak to that, whether it's knowledge or information or ideas that have been out there in the world and continue to be with us, and themes of issues that are with us. And I think that's been one of the reasons I've been interested in using materials that somehow touch on that.
Like books?
For example, books. And especially with what's happening to books today. Again, speaking to timelessness, which to me, I think about change. Life is constantly changing. With books, the role of the book is changing. And transmitting and accessing information through light technology, the computer.
And it seems that books, as we have known them, bound with paper and printed, in some ways form continuity or even a ongoing conversation through time. And I too wonder about I think I heard yesterday that digital books outsold printed books on Amazon this past year. And I wonder where that ongoing conversation, how it's going to materialize in the future.
Yeah, I think everyone has theories and ideas about that, but we really don't know until it will happen.
Until it will happen. And in your work, in your various installations, and in a minute I'd like you to address how you approach an installation, you do use books in various ways. And how do you go about finding these books, and what is your relationship with them as you're, in a sense, transforming them into something else?
Well, books come to me. and I do go out looking for them at library sales. You know, I'm very interested in the sales where you can get a bag of books for $5. So I often go to the library sales where I look around and look specifically for old, worn books with hardcovers. A book that demonstrates that it's had a life of some sort. It's been used and it's worn. When I was in New Zealand, which to me was a time of sort of renewal and sort of rejuvenating energy, giving myself an opportunity to focus on something else if I wanted to, depending on what happened. But in that experience, I found books came to me. I couldn't get away from them. I would take daily walks, and on one of the walks, I went by an old antique store and wandered in there and, of course, found some beautiful old books. But I ended up buying one and then having a conversation about books. And at that point, because of our conversation, every day I would walk by, he would leave a box of books there, and I would go, oh, my God. So I bought the box for $5 and went home and started destroying them essentially by cutting them up and flipping through them, looking at pages that might have interesting words or interesting marks or something that it would indicate that it had been used. I would go through that box, cut them up, separate it by covers and then by pages, and then start organizing them by different words or ideas that came to me as I was going through the books, and started essentially categorizing them. And I would do that, and then the next day I'd go for another walk, and there'd be another box of books. So it was like, well, I can either ignore this or I can continue with the fact that the universe is bringing me these books, and I somehow will continue working with books. And that's essentially has happened. I think what it gave me, especially given the context of that experience and some other thoughts that came to me and experiences that came to me while I was there, I've actually brought the books home and started looking and thinking about books a little differently and incorporating my working techniques and processes and approaching them thinking about process and technique. For an example, I'm cutting up books. And as I said, going back to the first comments I made about the changing role of the book, new technology, computer, light technology, I started thinking about books as screens, the connection of screens, focusing, looking, how we see with a book in connection to the computer of looking through screens and how that defines a whole other way of focusing, one working at a concrete material, the other looking at light. So maybe start thinking about that connection of the two and start thinking about how I can create work with that in mind. And also the idea of, you know, creating a book or making a film, there is an editing process involved in that. And what is editing? Editing is cutting and making cuts, choices. So I started thinking about that, and I thought, well, why not start cutting? And thinking about cutting as a process that will actually inform the work, given those thoughts, as well as maybe create something else through the cuts and see what happens. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's some of the thoughts that I've been thinking about as I've been approaching books now since I've returned.
And I want to direct the listeners to your website, which is brookhovey.com. That's BROOKEHOLVE.com. And she has a very nice website that you can see some of what we're talking about and how you use books with other objects as well to create an impression, an experience, really. And some of your work is larger installations that you really do walk into. And I'm intrigued with how do you approach something like that? How do you begin?
Well, that's an interesting question because sometimes there's a space I'm working with, sometimes not. And sometimes if I've created a piece for an installation before I've seen the space, I may put it in there and then it may change because of the space and I may look at it or display it differently depending on what the space is asking. I think part of when I'm working, thinking about installation, it's a way to enlarge the work. Books are very small. They're very intimate. They're meant to be held. They're meant to be touched and looked at, flipped through pages if they're in a traditional format. When you're in a space, you're talking about a very different kind of experience, which touches on other kinds of feelings and thoughts and ideas that can somehow be sometimes untouchable. They're more about sensation and feeling. And I think that's what's intrigued me about the idea of working in installation format rather than the individual book or constructions that I make, although I can create that in a smaller scale sometimes through the smaller constructions. I think once you make things larger and place them on a wall or place them at different parts of walls or on floors, is animize a word? Is that the word I'm trying to think of?
It is now.
Yeah, thank you. It animizes a space. Yeah, I don't think that is, but what I mean, you know, it makes it alive, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And in a way that otherwise just walking into a room, it's just a room.
Right.
So I when I think of that, I think of the space. I think of ways of trying to make the space as important as the work. So it's in some ways I like the idea of being able to be given a space and then see what I can do with it. Although it is another kind of challenge when I have the work and then I'm given another space and what do I do to make this work differently in another context.
Tell us a little bit about the show you have going on right now at Quicksilver, and it seems like you're going to have another one coming up soon. So tell us about the pieces in that show and the upcoming one.
I'm one of 13 artists in the Baker's Dozen at Quicksilver. We are all artists that work with words in some way. Words still do enter my work occasionally, and so I did have some work that I could share in this show. And the work tends to be work with book covers. I think all of them, maybe with the exception of one, all the work and the materials of them are book covers. There's one series which is very much connected to books in the sense that I call it the Irreverent series. And again, it also speaks, as I spoke earlier, to this process of cutting up books and which some people are appalled, even though, you know, books are being thrown away everywhere today. But there certainly is that history of burning books and cutting up and destroying that is a concern for many people. So I sort of played on that because I came across a cover with the word irreverent. and cut that up and then combined it with some other covers and started playing with that and then coming up with some other words and then focusing on words that aren't that important, like calling a piece "the" and including the word "the" in there. Actually, I have several covers that have "the" on it. And I originally, that series was originally a book that I decided not to bind, to keep just on card format, and made a box for it and inserted in there. And then for the show, I started looking at it and thinking, you know, I flip through these and I don't really pay attention to this because they're small. They're quite small. And I thought, I'm not really paying that close attention to the individual work. So what happens if I frame one? I made that decision to frame five sides, both of these. Now, these, mind you, the covers actually have two sides. So I thought, well, let me decide and select a few. Let me say I selected five in this case to frame out of maybe 10 of them. So I ended up framing them. And in the show, Kaisi has arranged them two pieces together. So there's this sort of juxtaposition of one against the other, which I think was interesting. I was originally thinking of them having them as a series, but she has split them up. And I think it works beautifully in the way that she has displayed them. I find them interesting because the framing does, for me, it asks me and invites me to go up even closer and really look at them carefully. And so I was very pleased in terms of that. But it created an interesting decision on which side to show. So my way of dealing with that in this particular series was actually giving them the title of the back page that you can't see. So it brings in the back page. And then on the back of each one, I also have a Xerox, color Xerox of the other side. So it still allows you to see it and access it as a book form, if, or book page if one wants to. So anyway, that was one series that's in the show. Another one is called another book that I used mainly with book covers is Wind. I called Wind Egg, and that's one that actually speaks to the wind. Again, the wind is this element, and I think that's the issue. Going back to timelessness, I see the wind as part of that, and of course, egg is another sort of cosmic symbol that speaks to timelessness. And anyway, I played with the worn and the weathered qualities of the wind within that context of that book, trying to find very worn book covers.
Your work seems, for you, a very thoughtful and cerebral process, and very much of a process that arrives into a piece that may be small or room-sized. So it seems a different way than maybe some other artists work in a purely visual sense.
Mm-hmm. I guess I need something, but it helps me keep focused in a way that otherwise I think I'm all over the place. It grounds me, so to speak.
So these are some of the works at the Quicksilver Gallery, Kaisi Horns Gallery in Forestville. And you have another show coming up in March, is it?
In March. And it's a show that I have named it In Material. It's a play on words speaking to a range of materials from concrete, heavy, weighted materials like stones to the materials of light. So more of the immaterial. And in this case, there's three of us, three artists. One, Susan Field. I was particularly attracted to her stones, so I approached her and asked her if she might be interested in participating. And then Elizabeth Shear, who's a Berkeley artist who works primarily with digital technology and light medium, asked her if she might join us. And then I see my work as somewhat in between. So we have the show we have named In Material coming up, and I think it'll be an interesting show.
Well, when does that show open?
That show actually opens it runs from March 4th through April 10th, and the reception, the opening is on Saturday, March 5th from 4 to 6.
Great. Well, books are involved in your work a lot, and are you a big reader?
Lately, I haven't been doing much reading just because I've been focusing on the work. Uh-huh. You know, I think my pattern is sort of erratic. Years ago, I was on book clubs with other friends, and I found I could never keep to this irregular pattern of reading that book clubs ask one to do, at least if I felt like I wanted to be a part of a book club. So I ended up leaving them. And just because I do, I read in spurts. And I go, you know, there'll be times when I read a lot, and then there are other times when I have these dry spells and don't read at all.
I have to admit to the same kind of pattern. Well, when sometimes you're driven to do other things, especially the kind of work you do, I'm really struck by the thoughtfulness and the way of synthesizing idea and form in the natural and the fabricated, and making something unique and new out of it. So I want to encourage our listeners to check out your work online at brookholvey.com and to visit the Quicksilver Gallery. Thanks, Brooke.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Suzanne, I really enjoyed that. It's a very, very interesting concept, what Brooke Holvey is doing with books, and look forward to seeing that show in Quicksilver Gallery. So you've been listening to A Novel Idea. Our guests tonight were Deborah Rodriguez, the author of A Cup of Friendship, and also Cobble Beauty School. And our other guest was Brooke Holvey, who talks about art and books and the relationship between them. So that's our show for tonight. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
You've been listening to A Novel Idea on KRCB.